the brunt of the avalanche didn't hit the team. They all had to take cover and they got hit with debris. But the big, you know, chunks of ice that will kill you were, you know, didn't hit the team. Now, would they have hit me had I been up there? I don't know.
Hey, everybody. Hey, I got Tom Lawrence back here. We just podcasted him late in March. He went up Everest on roughly around the 7th, I think it was, Tom. Is that about right, of April?
That's right.
Turns out that he went up during a time that turned out to be the deadliest, certainly one of them, if not the deadliest, times on Everest. Outdoing, which isn't anything we're happy to say, the Krakauer story of Into Thin Air, where I think it was 8 or so people died in a storm up there under treacherous conditions. And Tom just went up to do his second summit, and 11 died. And he was on that trip, and we pray and we're sad for all those people that died. On the other hand, we're thrilled that Tom made it back alive. And he's here, and we're going to chat with him about that. This is totally unscripted. We're just going to talk and see where it goes and what the story was. And Tom, welcome back from the mountain, man. We're thrilled to have you back. We're all worried about you. Threw a blog out there asking everyone to pray and think about you, get your good vibes. And the good news was within, I think, 4 or 5 hours of sending that out, you pinged me and you were back. So I didn't know you were back, but I'm glad you are. Welcome back, and how are you feeling?
Thank you, Craig. Thanks for having me back. I feel good. I'm disappointed because of the way things turned out, and I'm also, of course, sad for the people who didn't make it back, and including a couple of folks I know who, you know, they had reached the summit and were coming back down and passed away on the way down. It was tragic.
Did you know that doctor from Utah?
I did not know him. I know someone who knows him, but I don't know him personally.
Well, let's bump into the details here about what happened in just a minute. Let's first talk about your training. When we were last talking, you were training like a madman. You were doing crazy inclines with heavy weight on your back on treadmills and a plethora of nutty stuff. As I said, you know, you guys who do this thing are cut of a different cloth. I think you're all a bit crazy. Nothing wrong with that, man. I've been called crazy too, but hey, you're way upside in that club. But how did the training go? How did it go?
You know, the training was great, and I'll tell you, you know, the two supplements that actually that's not true. I took three of your supplements, but the two that I took the AFA and the AltaFuel, and I want to tell you, and again, you're paying me nothing for this, but I didn't have a headache the entire time I was acclimatizing, and no signs of altitude sickness, and was really thrilled about that. The training was great. The support I got from your supplements was great. And in the first, 6 or so weeks of my trip were good. I acclimatized well, but I learned some important lessons from this trip. And the main one is to really understand the philosophy of the guide that you choose to take you up the mountain. And, that's really important. When I climbed Denali, a few years ago, I had a guide who, and it's different on Denali because everybody's roped together. Whereas on Everest, you're not roped together. You're typically being guided by one guide or one Sherpa. But on Denali, my guide, a guy named John Race from Northwest Mountain School up in Leavenworth, Washington, he was really great at setting a pace that I was comfortable with. I'm probably on the slower side of people who climb these big mountains, and it's just kind of what works for me.
But that's a blessing too. And at that altitude and on those steeps, that's really a blessing. You're lucky you want to be a slow climber in that altitude.
Right. I agree with you. And on Denali, I had a guide who was very much like that, and I think that's one of the reasons that the climb really, it was not incredibly tough, and I was able to summit. And one of the things I'm not gonna call him out, even though people can go back and look at my social media and figure, and I really have great things to say about these guys. But let me say a couple of things about my Everest guides this year. Some of the best climbers on the mountain, And also some of the most giving people, you know, they would, if, for example, on one of our first trips to the ice fall, one of my teammates who summited, we were going through the ice fall and he was crossing one of the ladder crossings, and the ladder crossing was a little bit sketchy. The ladder wasn't fitting into the side of the ice very well. And he fell off. And, so he's hanging there, you know, he's clipped in to the rope, but he's hanging there, in this, you know, I don't know how deep this crevasse was. You couldn't really see the.
Yeah. Hold that thought, 'cause I just want to create some context for what you're saying for people who don't know. So the ice falls that we talked about that earlier, this is a dangerous mountain, man. People take it for granted because it's Everest and they hear it over and over and over again. And people have come a bit desensitized to the fact that this is a brutal climb. It's not kind. It's very, very hard work. And the ice falls are after you do the climb to base camp is one of the first areas you go through that's exceedingly dangerous. There's seracs. There's major, giant, almost icebergs, and they break off and they move and they're cranking and they're turning all the time. And the ladders that Tom is talking about, these are ladders. They're not climbing up ladders at this point. They're walking across them, and underneath them are these deep crevasses. So you can see the bottom of some of these, and some you can't see the bottom at all. And so he's saying that someone slipped and fell and is hanging on, probably not for his dear life because he's roped going over these things. But this has got to be a harrowing experience. So this is what he's talking about, and this is what he's looking at when this is going on. Is that about sum it up, Tom?
That sums it up really, really well, Craig. Yeah, so he's hanging there under this ladder, and my guide is him. He's great. He and one of the Sherpas, they attach ropes to him. They get him out. But the cool thing was this ladder needed to be fixed, and there's a group of Sherpas called the Icefall Doctors who are paid to take care of all these ladder crossings in the icefall. But he didn't wait for those guys. He went in because, again, this guy's an expert. He's been on the mountain many years, and he got his group, and we spent 45 minutes or so there repairing that ladder. The point of all that to say, my guides were expert climbers, some of the best on the mountain, very giving of their time and energy. But one of the things that I learned quickly is that I probably could have done a better job vetting what their philosophy was on how fast they wanted to move. Because one of the things right away that I saw, my coach, who's Scott Johnston from Uphill Athlete, you know, he was adamant throughout my training, and he was also adamant that, you know, look, once you get on the mountain, you know, you need to keep your heart rate. I think it was 140-ish was where he didn't want my heart rate getting above that, because he said it could really impact your acclimatization if you, especially, you know, even on the trek, getting that heart rate up above 140 too much could affect my acclimatization. So I was, you know, I was pretty diligent about that. And my guide, you know, he pretty much took off, which is fine. I mean, you know, there were other parts of his team who were back with people like me, who needed to go at a slower pace and wanted to go at a slower pace. So it wasn't a big deal, but it did kind of make me think, you know, we might have a different philosophy on how fast to go. And once we actually got to base camp and started the climb, I learned that actually we did have he had a different philosophy on how fast he wanted to go. And that became a frustration, I think, for him and for me, you know, as the acclimatization period went on.
That's very interesting. I want to ask you more questions about that. But first, I want to say in our first podcast, which, by the way, was also the last one we aired, so we've got Tom here back to back, I really strongly recommend, if you haven't heard that one, listen to that first, because some great context is set up for the difficulty of what he was about to embark on. And it's uncanny that it ended up being as unfortunate out there as it was. But first off, we were very transparent in that interview that AltaFuel was a product that is designed to push back at acute mountain sickness and help at altitude. I designed it, you know, with my own chemistry in mind, but really at altitudes around, you know, maybe 13, 14,000 feet. Tom was heading up to 30, just to give you an idea, and he went higher than I've ever used it at. So I'm thrilled to know that it helped. I'm thrilled to know, because I know that the first time you climbed, you were pushed back because of AMS. That got in the
way. That's right.
Yeah, and it's very, very wise when you get sick, as we talked about in that podcast. You've got to turn around. You've got to come back, because AMS, acute mountain sickness, is the first sign in a string of things that can go wrong, and you have to obey that illness. So you can't say, well, I'll get over this and I'll be okay. You know, it doesn't work that way. You simply have to go back down to an altitude where you can get your footing and hopefully mitigate or erase the effects, and then maybe take another attempt. So I'm thrilled to know that on this event, that the very purpose for which this supplement was made seems to have served its purpose, and it was untried and untested in that sort of environment. So I appreciate your using it. I appreciate the feedback, and I'm glad that we were able to help you in some way there. So that's cool to hear. I have never heard of this concept of climbing philosophy and heart rate management. The stuff that I do doesn't require heart rate management. It's, it could be tough. I might need to stop and rest for a bit. But you have to manage the entire hike. Again, brand new concept to me, based on maintaining a certain heart rate that doesn't go above X, because you'd be stopping all the time and never get where you want to go. Slow would turn into stop if you didn't manage that heart rate. Is that so?
That's exactly right. And Scott, again, my coach, he and a guy named Steve House wrote a book called Training for the New Alpinism, and it goes into a lot of that. And I'd recommend anybody who's going to be out in the mountains doing a lot of endurance work, consider picking that up, because there's a lot in there about staying in these lower training zones. Because many of us, if you like to get out and move, you're going to automatically sort of get that heart rate too high if you're not watching it.
Yeah, that makes just a whole bunch of sense. It just never occurred to me. I always assumed that the pace that you went was dictated purely by the mountain. But what you're saying is true. I mean, some people can, even in that environment, some people can pace differently than others. And even those people that can, probably should back it up a bit, because it's a long way up there, man. It's a long way up, and you can't burn out early on. And climbing philosophy also makes a whole bunch of sense. You do have to match up with the team you're climbing with. But on that note, again, this also makes sense. I hadn't thought of it, but it makes complete sense, because I would imagine that the team you're climbing with, the group you join, articulates their philosophy before they go up. And if they don't, that's a misstep on their part. You should not be having to figure that out on the way up. And I think the team leader is accountable for that. Did they not articulate their way of thinking once they got on the mountain, until they got on the mountain?
Yeah, not really. And I think I, the error I made was, I went with one of their, I went out and trained, before I went to Nepal, with one of the guys in the group who, one of the leaders who ended up not going on the trip. And, if there was going to be a philosophy discussion, I probably would have heard it there, but I didn't. And really, I'm willing to take some responsibility too. I assumed that, my coach would know that there was a consistent philosophy. But again, it was, ultimately I take responsibility that I should have really made sure that there was a consistent view on the approach. And I'll just tell you a little bit about what happened. And I think and just to help everybody understand. So what I found out after I came down is that several of the big guiding services, Climbing the Seven Summits, IMG, they had several guys who ended up summiting. It took them, 9+ hours to get from base camp to Camp One. The first time that we went up to Camp One, it took me about 7 hours.
Okay, so the average time to base camp is about what?
Well, I was told the average time from base camp to Camp One was about 7 hours.
Okay, so 9 hours. So we have a 2 hour, a huge discrepancy. That's a big difference.
Yeah, now my guides were telling our team that they really wanted us to get to Camp One in 5.5 hours. And some people can do that. There were two or three folks. There were five climbers on my team. They were super strong and very fit, and they could get to Camp One in 5.5 hours. I could not do that. And so one of the I think the frustrations, my guide told me at one point, he said, "Look, he said, it frustrates me to go that slowly. It just kind of drives me crazy. I'm not going to do it." And which is, again, is fine. But one of the things that happened, just dealing with that frustration, and probably, him dealing with the frustration of me, because I was frustrating for him. And that disconnect on how much time, it was going to take, I think, wore on me and it wore on him. And it came down, you know, it's a little bit crazy when I think about it now. I was fully acclimatized. And, you know, again, because of the AltiFuel and the AFA, I was, I'd never had a headache. I was feeling good. You know, you're out there for that long and you're kind of isolated. And, you know, I was away from my girlfriend and missing her. And by the time we went up for the summit attempt, when we were going through the ice fall, I was pushing too hard and too fast. And you know, I ran myself down, and I knew everybody else was frustrated with me. And I just said, you know what? This is not feeling right. It's not feeling good. I'm out. I'm done. And it's a little bit, when I look back in retrospect, you know, sitting here in my office in Memphis, Tennessee, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, why couldn't I have? Because he had done a great job. He had told me, he said, look, we're going to put you and me and another person who was also, she had had some difficulty during the climb. We're going to put you guys on oxygen at Camp One. So he was very gracious in that way. And I really, and I, because most people don't start oxygen until above Camp Two. So he was going to put us on oxygen early, because when we had been at Camp Two on a previous rotation, we had gotten on oxygen and we were just super. We were both really, really just much stronger, which, you know, makes sense. But what I really needed, I wish now I'd had the courage to ask for it. What I really needed was for him just to say, hey, look, if it takes you 7 hours, if it takes you 9 hours to get to Camp One, don't worry about it. We've got plenty of Sherpa here on the team who can go with you. Just get there. Because I talked to these other guide services after I came down, and they were just like, oh man, you know, you would have been average on our team. And so, you know, I didn't get that from him. I take responsibility for not saying, hey, this is what I need. But, you know, I didn't do that out of fear that, you know, this fear that he was going to say, well, then you just can't go up. You know, if you can't commit to trying to go faster, you can't go up.
Yeah, that's a rational fear. A lot of people have the fear after spending all that time training more than the money. It's expensive to do this. It's anywhere, depending on who you are and what your equipment is, it's anywhere from, I'll pick a low number, 30, 35K to 100K to do this. And it's a substantial time of your life before you even get out to Nepal. It's I think we talked about this also in the first podcast. Training aside, I mean, I just read an article of someone who spent 3 years training for this. Now, they had their reason to have to do it that way. And that person reported that even after 3 years of training, they did everything right. They were training at high altitudes. They were training using hypoxic chambers at sea level. They did all this crazy stuff and all this. And they got on the mountain, and their feedback when it was done was, nothing prepares you for it. Nothing. Of course, the training matters. You can't not train. But no matter what you do, the mountain's going to push back at you. And you can't go through all this time, energy, and effort and be fearful. You don't want to go through all this time, energy, effort, and expense and be fearful that the leader's going to say, gee, you know, you're not going to make it. But as a former athlete and a former coach also, I did a lot of coaching. I hear you. I understand you're taking personal responsibility, and I think that's mature. But I'm not sure that I agree with you on this. I think that it's any good coach is able to identify who's on the team and what's going on, and it's their job. It's a coach's problem to identify variances on the team and manage that. Now, Everest is a little different. It's a rougher, tougher, meaner, nastier environment, and Tom was there during the deadliest season, I think, ever. But no one should be put in that position. And when you say that the other coaches, trainers, leaders, the mountain leaders, the expedition leaders were saying you would have been average, what Tom is saying is that for that group, he would have fit right in. But I am a bit disappointed to hear that you were with somebody who wasn't able to better manage you. And you're looking back at it. See, you're looking back at it and you're wishing you'd said something. But I come from the point of view that is my own philosophy, that you take the best information you have at the moment that you're in, and you do what you do. In the moment, I think you did exactly what you should have done, and I do hold the expedition leader to a level of higher accountability for not being able to identify the issue and manage it, and I think that he should have done that. No climber who spends that much time, who spends that much money trying to summit Everest should go there with anything but I feel like my expedition leader has my back. Man, I'm on the right team. Even if I'm on the wrong team, you should be made to feel like you're on the right team. And I don't know if you can do this on Everest. Can you? You can't. No, you can't switch expeditions. You're on the team you're on, right?
I know that each expedition group that, you know, they hold the permit for the climbers. It's funny. I actually thought about that. I thought about going to one of the other groups and saying, hey, you know, what would you charge me? You know, it doesn't seem like my, you know, the folks I'm with are real comfortable with my pace. You know, if you guys are okay with my pace, what would you charge me for me to come over here and kind of finish this last week up with you guys? And I thought about doing that, but I just, again, when you've been out there for 6 or 7 weeks and you're kind of beat down anyway, it's difficult to think through those things.
You're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. I mean, it's just not a natural thing to do, because that's a pushback, a big pushback mentally and psychologically. And the natural instinct for even the most, you know, experienced athlete is going to be, well, you know, maybe we'll be doing this again in a couple of years. It doesn't feel like this is going to happen. It's just the way you think
right.
when you're beat down and you're at altitude or whatever the case may be. But that's a very interesting lesson for anybody who's got this sort of thing on their mind. Really match up with the climbing philosophy. Make sure you have the right person and maybe take even the extra steps and say, well, what happens if, and bring up the if scenarios.
You know, that's a really a great point, Craig. That's the thing I've really thought a lot about is, you know, if I am going to come back and do this again, what would I do differently? And that's for sure. And I think, again, one of the reasons once you're on the mountain that you don't do that, or I didn't do that, is just because of fear that you're going to get, you know, told you can't go. But again, on the front end, you can ask anything. When you're trying to select somebody, I should have done a better job of asking those questions on the front end.
Well, you know, after you shake this whole experience off, probably right now, I'm going to just make a go out on what I think is a short limb and say probably immediately following leaving the mountain, you were thinking, yeah, I think I'm done with this stuff. Probably not going to do this anymore. And then what happens is months and days, weeks and months go by and you start thinking, yeah, I think I could probably do this again. I've learned a lot. And man, I can't believe, you know, I had a different kind of failure last year on the mountain. Had to come out after 3 days because I just made some stupid mistakes. And the amount of stuff I learned on those 3 days is just, it's an encyclopedia of knowledge you get each day. It's almost an exponential learning curve. And when you walk out, you just know so much more. And you're certainly in that situation. Before we get into, you know, the hike itself here, did you have those feelings? Did you think, screw this, I don't think I'm going to do this anymore? And how are you feeling now?
Yeah, I told my girlfriend that I don't think I'm gonna come back here. And here ended up within a couple of days, like, well, I don't think I'm gonna come back and climb on the south side again. Because one of the things, just a quick aside, one of the things that happened after I came down, I was in my tent, and I all of a sudden I start hearing the radios in our base camp, you know, going crazy. And I look up in the icefall, and my team got hit by an avalanche after I came down.
Well, there you go, folks. And, I mean, there it is. I mean, the icefalls gave how big an avalanche?
Well, it was big. Somebody took a video of it. And the thing is, I was moving pretty far behind the team. The brunt of the avalanche didn't hit the team. They all had to take cover and they got hit with debris. But the big, you know, chunks of ice that will kill you were, you know, didn't hit the team. Now, would they have hit me had I been up there? I don't know. But I did have a thought right then. I was like, okay, two things. Number one, it looks like the universe might have done me a favor there. And number two, if I come back and do this, I think I would rather go on the north side where you don't have the ice fall. And so that was one of my first thoughts after I started thinking, well, maybe not never, but maybe never for the south side.
Yeah, the Khumbu icefalls are just villainous, man. This is what we were just talking about a minute ago with the ladders that go across these crevasses that this team member fell into, who was roped off. And we talked about the this in the first podcast. We touched on it here, but these are building size icebergs that are moving constantly. They make sounds, they make noises, and often break apart and fall down and create ice avalanches there. And you can not only die falling into a crevasse there, which people do, you can die in an avalanche there, and people have. I think, again, in the first podcast, we talked about one year not too long ago, in recent years, there's a major avalanche in the ice falls, and it took out an entire expedition and maybe an expedition plus.
Yeah, that's right.
Very dangerous place. I want to get into your experience now, and, unless there's something else you want to add before we just sort of just walk through this harrowing adventure, how far up you got, where exactly you decided to turn around, and what you saw there. Is there anything else you want to just throw in here before we make this leap?
No, that's good. Let's jump in.
All right. So we get to base camp. You're feeling good. What's base camp like this year for you? Just walk us through. You get there, you get your tent up. But give me the base camp experience this year.
Well, base camp again is a massive place. And there are pictures on the internet, but it's hard to really appreciate. I mean, I want to say that it takes 20 minutes to hike from one end of base camp to the other. There's places is huge. I mean, I want to say there's 800 or more people that are camped in this area during April and May, and so it's like a small city. And our little section of base camp, there were five tents for the climbers, and then tents for the guides, and then tents for the Sherpa and the support folks. There were probably, I want to say, 15-ish of those folks who were there to support us, just for our team. And so that's kind of what it's like.
I had no idea that base camp was that big, that it was effectively a 20-minute walk. This is a great, stupid question. I just want to ask it anyway. Is it a 20-minute walk because it's a natural 20-minute walk, or is it because you're at altitude and you have to walk slow?
Once you're acclimatized, it's a pretty natural walk. You're moving pretty well. And I think even for somebody like me who's slower than some of the folks there, it's still probably for most people about a 20-minute walk from one end to the other.
Yeah, again, to give a little context, base camp still is this, but it's been augmented. And this is that you get there, you set up your tent, you got your food, you got your gear, you get all your stuff, and it's home camp for quite some time while you'll acclimatize. So they have now, I think, a permanent mess tent up there, don't they? Medical tent and food tent.
There is a medical tent. It's called the Himalayan Rescue Association. And they have I want to say two or three doctors there throughout the season. I think each expedition group has their own mess tent where they get their food.
I see. So they go up there in advance and set that up, or do they do that at the same time?
Typically, I think it's done before the climbers get there, because I know, at least for our group, when we got there, everything was all set up and prepared.
Okay, cool. All right. So what happens next?
Well, so you get there and you've gone from roughly 10,000 feet when you fly into Lukla from Kathmandu. You've gained 7,700 or so feet getting to base camp over an approximately 10-day period. So the first thing you do is, that's a pretty good amount of altitude to gain over a 10-day period. So you rest for a few days once you get to base camp, and then the idea is to start moving up the mountain slowly. So I want to say the first thing that we did was go up to into the icefall to an area called the soccer field, which is I want to say approximately 2/3 of the way up the icefall. So we went up through there, and then came back down, rested for a couple of days, and then went to Camp One. And once at Camp One, we spent the night, two or three nights there, and then came back down, rested for a few days, went to Camp One, then went to Camp Two. And the goal was to tag Camp Three. We couldn't, nobody in our group made it all the way to Camp Three, but we went a fair distance, or most of us did, up the Lhotse face towards Camp Three.
All right. And can I assume that the trek between each camp to the next camp is sort of the same terrain, looks the same roughly, and is all as difficult? Or is this, other than altitude, is this successively harder because of terrain and altitude, or just altitude?
It's actually really, each step is really different. Again, I didn't do the whole thing, of course, but you know, when you going from base camp to camp one, most of it's through the ice fall. It's difficult in the ice fall to really get a rhythm going with your hiking like you can on Denali, because everything's constantly changing. The head guide at IMG, Greg Vernovich, I was talking to him after I came down, and that was one of the things he was, for a bigger, because I'm about 200 pounds, because, you know, for a bigger guy like you, I can see where that would be even more, you know, challenging, because you really can't get a rhythm going, like, because I was telling him about, you know, how different my experience was on Denali, that it was, you know, much easier. So, yeah, it's hard to get a rhythm going in the ice fall. So once you get to camp one, though, the hike from camp one to camp two is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's, you know, you've got a couple of things right at the beginning, a couple of, you know, crevasses to get around or get through. But for the most part, the hike from camp one to camp two is some days a very hot walk up the valley towards camp three. And so then once you get to camp two, it changes a lot. Like camp two to camp three, you're on the Lhotse face, very steep climbing. You're having to, you know, use an ascender most of the time to stay fixed or to stay secure to the rope. And then again, I didn't get to camp three, and certainly not past it. But from camp three to camp four, I think it's the same sort of thing. And then once you, after camp four, you're on the summit ridge, moving up towards the summit.
Okay, and let's talk about where you got hung up, and then get into the debacle that happened up there. So we know you weren't able to summit. My assumption the whole time was you were a victim of this insane level of both inexperience that was up there. Every year there's a profound amount of inexperience in a group of people that I say really have no right to be there. Now, when I say that, anyone has a right to go. If you can spend the money and you want to put your life on the line, you can do that. The most experienced climbers do this. We talked about Rob Hall and Scott Fisher, two of the world's greatest alpinists that ever were, and certainly the two top at the time, died up on Everest, and they knew what they were doing. If you want to put yourself, your life on the line, that's fine, but you should do it with a deep amount of experience when you take on a mountain like Everest or K2 or even Denali. Even Mount Washington in the United States is a killer mountain. Just doesn't seem like it, but what happened? What prevented you? Because I was thrilled to know that finally altitude, sickness didn't get in the way, and mm-hmm. you were physically trained, and you were really ready for this more than I think any other time before based on the information you gave me. What got in the way for you?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest thing was, again, is just how this emphasis on, you know, hey, we want you to go faster, and it feels a little silly, again, looking back in retrospect. But it just, you know, it went on for 6 or 7 weeks. And let me be transparent too. I am not, and if my guide were on here with us, he would probably be the first to tell you this. I am not the most organized person in the mountains. It's something I need to work on. And I know that was a frustrating thing for him. They would be waiting on me to get going and that kind of thing. You know, and so he and I had a lot of conflict over my pace and over, you know, not being organized enough and that kind of thing throughout the acclimatization period. And I think what happened is on that last day when we were heading up for our summit attempt, just going through the ice fall, I pushed myself more than I should have to try, because I was like, you know what, I'm just going to push it and try to keep up with these guys. And I got tired. I got a little bit beat down, and I was frustrated that, because intuitively, I think I kind of thought what I found out later was that I wasn't the only person on the mountain who was going slowly. Now, There was one guy in my group who went around my pace. He decided not to even go up on the summit attempt. He had fallen in a crevasse early on, and he had you know, injured his knee a little bit and injured.
He must have been shaken up big time.
He was. And this is not the guy who fell on the ladder. This is somebody else, and he had decided just not to go up at all. So I was kind of the only slow guy left. For sure, two of the faster guys, you know, they could keep up with the guide, and the third person was doing a pretty good job too. And so I was, you know, I was really beat down emotionally. And I think my thought was is that it's hard to get back in that headspace, but I think I was just like, you know, I'm just going to wait for another time.
It is tough to get back in that headspace. I can relate to it, having, again, your situation is very extreme, but the minute you have the emotional or mental loss of a strength and power, and I can do this. And Everest is constantly doing it, even when you have that positive mentality. It's always pushing back at you and always making you think twice. Every step, particularly in the death zone, but even before the death zone, every step, many, many people, experienced people, are saying, fuck this, man. Why am I here? This is hard. It's harder than I thought, you know, and you just got to work it every step of the way, even when everything is going right for a lot of people. So when your emotions push back at you like this, it's really the beginning of the end in most cases, unless you can find a way to overcome that. And it's hard to do. It's hard to overcome that with less oxygen around you. So
what I really needed is for my guy to say, hey, look, don't worry. If it takes you 9 hours to get to Camp One, don't worry about it. Because remember, we're going to get you on oxygen at Camp One. You know how strong you felt on oxygen when we were up at Camp Two. Just hang in there. You know, get there. Just get there. That's really what I needed to hear.
I also think you're being a little hard on yourself in terms of the disorganization. I get that because I have some of that problem too. With camp, I actually am not disorganized once I get there, but preparing for my events, look at, I feel you on the disorganization thing, but you're making it sound, or for the audience, Tom is, you may get from what Tom just said here that he's unique in this sense, and the fact is he's not. This is not uncommon at all. These experienced expedition leaders deal with this. It's part of what happens. They're the experts. We're the climbers. And again, Tom could be better. I'm sure you could be a better. I think it's, you know, again, transparent and exceedingly mature to point out your own shortcomings here, and probably they have to improve. But the fact is, this is not unique. You know, look, and I'm trying to be objective here because I think it's important to be objective. But I think that while there was a lot for you to learn and your climbing skill sets have improved from this, it's still up to the expedition leader. That's his job. His job is not to take people who paid and just laissez-faire, just let it be and go the way it goes. I'm pushing back just a little bit at what you're saying. Sure, shoot away for some improvement, but I still think, especially where you were on the climb, it was up to him to bring you through, unless there was a life-threatening problem, which there clearly was not at this point.
Well, the one thing that I will agree with you on, as far as all that goes, is that, you know, with just I really believe that with just a little bit of understanding about the pace, especially, I feel more strongly about this after talking to some of the other leaders in base camp and kind of being affirmed a little bit about, you know, my pace being very average. I think with just a little bit of compassion and a little bit of understanding about the pace, I know I could have made it to Camp One, but I think there's a really good chance that I could have made it on up the mountain. And as you pointed out, I wasn't up there, but it was apparently it was crazy, as some of the pictures show. And one of the things that's not been publicized a whole lot, the 11 deaths were horrible. But I had lunch with a couple of folks after I got to Kathmandu, and several people in the group that they were in got frostbite, you know, lost fingers and toes, or we're possibly going to lose fingers and toes. And so, that's something that's not being talked about a whole lot.
Well, and that's another good point here. I want to make some points here. Death, not summiting, and frostbite are normal for this mountain. When Tom says, you know, I think I could have made it, you have to understand that when you pay to go to Everest, when you train to go to Everest, there's absolutely no guarantee. Forget guarantees. How about probably, I don't know the numbers, maybe you do, but I don't know if it's 50-50 that you make it to the top, or 60-40 or 40-60, but the odds, if they're in your favor, they're low, and probably they're not, they've got to be statistically against you. So Everest, you know, no matter what you do, you may or may not make the summit, more likely probably not than make it. It's normal to not make it. And secondly, frostbite is a natural part of this sort of thing. It happens all the time. Way up at the Hillary Step is where hell begins, I think, this year. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Hillary Step is the last staging point before you push for the summit. And this year, there was a line so long, so stupidly long because of the number of permits that were allowed, that I understand that that people in that line were stuck sitting still up in the death zone where you are slowly dying, even with oxygen, for 12 hours. I also heard that a lot of the expert climbers were bellowing through their oxygen masks things like, this is not the place for first-time climbers to be. This is not the place for inexperienced people. So not only were people in deep shit in the death zone at the Hillary Step, sitting around for 12 hours where someone died of a heart attack, and in fact, there was an image of a climber tied to a rope and hanging over the side of the Hillary Step dead. This guy was dead. And so this whole thing of too many permits, inexperience, and sitting around for 12 hours was the big kick this year. Is that am I on the right track here?
Well, and one of the things that contributed to a lot of the challenges this year, I want to say last year there were 11 good summit days what you're dealing with most of the year, 50 weeks of the year, and I think we talked about this last time, the jet stream is sitting right on top of the summit. You can't go up there.
Yeah, there's a window of opportunity or very few opportunities to actually summit. And just talk about that for a minute. Talk about that window.
Well, last year there were about 11 days when the weather, was decent to go up there. This year there were only 5. And so I think that made the challenge even tougher for the guides to deal with and try to figure out, when's a good time to go and how do we do that? And frankly, I don't know what, they're smart.
When do they figure that out, Tom? When do they decide when is a good time to go? They don't figure this out at base camp or camp 1 or camp 2. They figured this out really at camp 4 or at the Hillary Step. I mean, you're way up, aren't you, when they figure that out?
Well, from what our folks were telling us, you have to, because, it takes 5 or 6, five-ish days for the normal person to actually make the move from base camp and get back up in position to be able to summit. So the guides are looking at weather reports from all different angles, trying to figure out, okay, what's going to be going on when we, by the time, 5 days from now. So I think that's one of the challenges too. They're having to look out that far to really try to, get a sense for what's going to be going on, by the time they get up there.
So that's another challenge. So this is it, at least twofold with my inexperience. I see two issues here. The first is trying to forecast from lower down, and everything can look perfect. Maybe they can look at weather.com up there, get a 10-day forecast, and you only have to deal with 5 days until you're way inside a clear window. And then you get there, and the unexpected happens, and a storm comes in.
That's right. That's right.
Now, did a storm come in this? I heard a storm came in also to exacerbate things this year. Did I get that right, or is that not so?
I'm not sure about that. I do know there were a couple of days that they thought that the guides thought were going to be good days and ended up being higher winds, and some days that they thought were going to be higher winds that ended up being good days, and that kind of thing. But I don't recall anything about a storm.
So what happened here? Hillary Step, too many people. Too slow. What happened?
Yeah, best I can tell is just too many people trying to summit at the same time, And like you alluded to earlier, too little experience. You know, our guides were commenting on some of the folks, and I can't remember where they were from, but they were wearing down in the icefall where it's not cold. They're wearing heavy parkas and just too many clothes where they're going to overheat. And I know there was some surprise on the part of our guides that these folks didn't have better guidance themselves.
Do you think that the expedition leaders, by and large, are, skilled enough to be bringing civilians, I'll call us, up, or do you think that most of these leaders, while talented and gifted in their own right, aren't yet ready for the business, which is where I think maybe your expedition leader fell short on the business side of things, managing you, and on the coaching side. But do you think that there needs to be, even on the expedition leader side, better training to get people up the mountain, or is it really more up to the individual before the death zone anyway to get to that summit?
Well, the expedition leaders that I'm familiar with, like I said, my guides are some of the most skilled climbers on the mountain. They're extremely, extremely competent, extremely professional. Where they fell short with me was just, I think their philosophy was just not really a good fit for my abilities and my ability to go fast. I think, they're more comfortable with people who can move faster. The way that they were looking at the weather, the way that they approached everything, and really the folks I was with last year too, same thing, very skilled and very, very professional, very knowledgeable. I suspect that one of the things that in a year like that, when you only have five good summit days and you're trying, and there's, seven, 800 people trying to summit, I don't know if you have to put limits on how many people can be above Camp 4 in a particular 24-hour period. I think people that are smarter than me are going to have to deal with that.
It brings up again the issue of who should be on the mountain and rights, which I talked about just a little bit earlier in this discussion here. And I'm of the thinking that you get two problems here. The Nepalese are poor, and so they do have a cap on permits. The problem is the cap is too high. It's too many people that they let in. And I'm of the mind that you really, on these deadly mountains, at some point, and I don't know where the demarcation line is and what mountain, you've got to have certain qualifications to get on this mountain. You should not be able to just go on this mountain and climb it without having demonstrated some deep experience on maybe some of the other seven summits, or at least be able to, I don't know how you do this, I don't know how you solve this problem, but it just seems to me this is a start, qualifying people, because when I first learned about the problem on Everest in the Krakauer book, Into Thin Air, of the 96 debacle, that was the first thing that went through my mind, is that there's so many people that have no right to be there. Now, right meaning based on their background and experience, no right to be there. No right to be there at all. They shouldn't be there. And a lot of those people that had no right to be there died. I still feel terrible and horrible. We don't want anything bad to happen to anybody. But this is a case of personal responsibility. And if you choose to do something that's way outside of your wheelhouse because it's a dream, and the dream is way outside your comfort zone and bigger than you, and you think people are going to carry you through, you're really not only putting yourself, your own life on the line, but you're endangering other people. And I think this has to be really thought about and revisited. I mean, this year, there was one guy I read while you were up there, while I think you were at least orbiting around this, maybe coming back, an Australian who the night before he tried the summit had posted to Facebook saying that he had a bad feeling, there were too many people, this didn't look good, and he doesn't feel right about it, but he still made his move, and this guy passed out. This is one of the people who lived to tell about it. He was lucky to be in a situation where he could, way up high, I'm not sure it was at the Hillary step, but he had a bad time, he got stuck, he was in the death zone, he was somehow able to get back to a lower camp, and then he would probably camp one, I think, is the highest the choppers can go. Is that right?
I think they can go to camp two, but I typically, I think they try to stay, camp one, yeah, or one.
Yeah, he was able to get down to camp one or two and chop it out and ended up in the hospital. So at least this guy survived. So this is one of the lucky guys this year. But they quote what happened here, short of in the Hillary Step and in the death zone, is death and carnage, chaos, you know, lineups, dead bodies on the route, tents at camp four, you know, people trying to turn around, dying, like this guy we talked about earlier, the doctor. I can't pull his name out, but is a doctor from Utah who summited. This guy made it to the top and died on the way down. Yep. Now, he died of a heart attack, and they don't yet know if the heart attack was due to the altitude or what, but or coming down slow or exertion. Maybe it was just his time. It could have been. But this is a man who actually made it to the top and died on the way down. And right. People, this is another thing. People don't realize that coming down, I think, might be the hardest part.
Yeah, you're exhausted, that's for sure.
Tom, I know you got to go. I hate to cut this off. There's a lot more to talk about, but we'll do it another time. Thank you so much. Thank God you're safe. We're glad you're back and safe and sound. And we'll talk again about the plans when you decide that you're going to go climb again, because I got a feeling you're going to do it.
Craig, thanks so much for having me back on.
Hey, the pleasure's mine, Tom. Thank God you're home safe, and we'll talk to you later. Take care, brother. Bye-bye.